I convened the Ag Policy Committee this morning, and we do have two bills on the calendar. We will not be hearing the Simonson bill. That we had it posted, but it didn't make it through the other committee to us yet, and so it's not likely we're going to hear it this week. So that was the task force, law enforcement task force bill. So anyway, if anyone's here for that bill, we're not hearing that one today. But we are hearing Hansen, House File 2798, and we do have that one in our packet. And we do have an amendment that's going to be an oral amendment to that. So I'm going to welcome to the committee Representative Hansen. You can begin by talking about that amendment, and then we'll have Colby address it as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In working with the stakeholders on this, there's a small oral amendment that I'd like to make to get the bill in the shape that I think it makes it better. Is on line 2.9. After the word with and before the word a, insert "and has a detectable level of." I think Mr. Sullivan has that. After the word "with," and then insert "and has a detectable level of." And if I could explain why that needed. So you could treat a plant with a pesticide, but it may not show up. So the way to validate whether it's been treated with is to have a detectable level of. So the department, let's say to enforce this, you have a plant that's labeled. They could go out and take a sample of that plant, and the proof would be to have the detectable level of. You can't prove it's treated if there's no detectable level. So that's why having that in there, I think, provide the proof on the on the labeling.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Sullivan, you've got that, and that works within the – is that correct? Okay. And Representative Hamilton, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you addressed it, Representative Hansen. What's the process, or how would they know whether or not? Is it a simple test if there's a detectable level, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, you know, we've funded a great laboratory at the Department of Agriculture, and when they have standards that they use in their chemical analysis, so they'd be able to analyze that plant material and then determine if there's a pesticide in there.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, to me that's almost kind of a moving target in that we used to detect parts per million. Now we're parts per billion. So with this wording, does it mean that any detectable level, no matter how minute, that might be detected years down the road as well?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, as you know, the science continues to improve as we invest in better equipment and that nice laboratory that we built for the people of Minnesota. But the detectable level is the enforceable component. And sometimes with the product, you have a very minute amount can have an impact on the insect. So my intent here is to have some type of standard that is beyond just being treated, because if you apply something, that is the act of applying, but to make sure that it's lethal or it has that detectable component in it, you have to be able to analyze for it. So yes, I believe that standards will improve and you'll probably go to a lower level over time that you can detect, but I think that you'd still have to have the rigor of the science being good to quantify that. So you'd have some — my purpose here is to make sure you have something that you can take action on rather than just the act of applying.
And I'm going to ask a question, then I'll turn it to Representative Hamilton. But I have a question of, as it reads, it has a detectable level of a pollinator lethal insecticide. Is that by application or by the residual effect? So is it at the beginning or is it at the end? Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, that does make sense. So,
Representative Hansen.
If you look at the clause that's being modified, it is the intent there is that it is the treatment is at the beginning and the detectable level is at the end. So it's a if-then. You know, it's an with and, I guess. So the intent, and so I'm clear on the record, is this would be the enforceable thing. So if the Department of Ag inspectors go out onto the site, you have a sign that says this is bee friendly. You take a sample of the plant. That's at that point when the advertisement has occurred. That's their verification in the retail business. That's the detection.
Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I have a couple questions. Just for clarification, Representative Hansen. One, who would be responsible for the cost of this? And then with that, if it's the state, we have a fiscal note, and then where's this bill going? The other thing, well, I'll let you answer that, and I have another question.
And Representative Hamilton, we're on the amendment. So is this kind of tied to the amendment, or is it?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. That's to the bill itself, I believe. So.
But.
So I can wait on that one then.
Okay, we'll follow up on that.
Then just to the amendment, what if there's once in a while you may get a little bit of drift or something from a neighbor? Are there penalties to the individual that would say one thing, right, to advertise one thing? And then what if there was some drift over from a neighbor or something like that? Who would be liable at that point?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, that's why it's the if-then, so it's the treated and. So if you had drift that was not from the application, that would not, it's an and if-then, that they've got to be doing the treatment and the detection. So you plant that plant and there's drift that comes in and you detect it. That wasn't the application that was made to it. That was inadvertent drift.
Okay, seeing no other questions. Oh, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is detectable level. You know, we keep pushing that envelope further and further, you know, down to parts per billion, you know, one drop in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and you can detect 2,4-D at those levels 3, 4, 5 years after they've been sprayed on a field. And so I guess that just detectable level is going to be a changing target that gets lower and lower and lower to the point that the drift issue, somebody 5 miles away sprays it and you might show up with a detectable level. And so I'd much rather have that a little bit more defined than just detectable level. One part per million, one part per whatever you think that should be, rather than just open detectable level, because you know, it keeps getting lower and lower, and we're just years away from, you know, everything is going to have something on it, you know. So,
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Faust, I did answer that question earlier, but I will answer it again. Yes, the target does move as the science gets better, but the Department of Agriculture has to make sure that they're following the protocols to make sure that it's an enforceable action that they do when they have that detectable level. They have the standards that they have to reach, and I believe that by putting this amendment in, it's better than just leaving it open-ended with saying that it needs to have the treatment. So you have the treatment and the detectable level. Yes, the science will continue to improve, but the rigor still has to be there to justify the enforcement action.
Sorry, I missed it before.
Oh, that's okay.
Any other questions regarding the amendment? Otherwise, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay? Motion prevails. Okay, now we've got the bill as amended. And Representative Hansen, you would like to speak to the entire bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this bill is a bill that deals with nursery stock. So it is relating to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. It is similar to the labeling requirements that we have relating to, well, you can look at the existing statute. We label nursery stock a variety of ways. This is adding a component in relating to truth in advertising for pollinator to protect pollinators. And some of you may have seen some media last fall where plants were sold that contained neonicotinoids that were not beneficial to pollinators. So this is a way, rather than banning neonicotinoids, rather than restricting their use, we're making sure that it's a truth in advertising requirement. I just want to point out, and we'll have some testimony, I did, when the Nursery and Landscape Association Day on the Hill was a couple weeks ago, went and talked with them, Representative McNamara as well. This is nursery stock. I think Representative Faust, relating to agriculture, and Representative Hamilton, there's probably not as much drift. I mean, there's some nursery stock that where we have the tree material growing outside. A lot of this is greenhouse activity where we're dealing with starting the plants and moving the bedding materials and the annuals, some of the perennials. So I think some of those concerns related to drift are probably more controllable in that interior scape. So what the bill does is it defines pollinator lethal insecticide. And this was a definition that I struggled with. And I want to be clear, I wrote the definition of pollinator lethal insecticide so that it would be more specific. There were systemic insecticides are broader, broader term. And I'm dealing with Mr. Shepard and legal counsel trying to make sure that we would write this as crisp and clear as we could. We just said, let's write this in terms of plain language. So that's the definition on subdivision 28A. And then we've just modified section E relating to the advertising. And it would go into effect the day after enactment.
We do have some questions. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Pompey. And I'm just curious, what type of equipment is used to test this, and would a small retailer have that equipment?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, the intent would not be the retailer to be testing the equipment. The regulatory role would be with the Department of Agriculture, where there's a laboratory where they take samples to analyze water, feed. I mean, they're doing these inspections and doing analysis as part of their regulatory role. So there's no requirement there for the retailer. It's not their responsibility is not to label that product, and they would have the knowledge of what to label based on the treatment that's applied. So it's a labeling requirement. We're not saying that the retailer tests the product before they put up the label. The testing is the way to do the regulatory validation is by the Department of Agriculture.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Pompey. Okay, so and not having sold much nursery stock, so if you get your stock in, you get your product in, you just leave it there until you're tested, so you don't even worry about this because you won't be testing this at all. Is that correct? So it's really not your problem as a retailer until the department comes by.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Kreisha, the responsibility is the labeling of the from the retailer on what label they're going to put up. If they don't know if it's been treated, then they don't put up a sign that says it's bee friendly. They can't. That's where we're talking about with the consumer. So they're not going to be testing. If they have doubt, they don't need to put up the sign. If they know the chain of custody, they've planted that plant and it doesn't have the neonicotinoid in there that's pollinator lethal, then they can put up the sign that says bee friendly. And then the consumer would have the knowledge to know that is bee friendly or pollinator friendly. So that's where the knowledge comes in. It's not to wait and see if it's tested before you can put it up. And I think there's folks here from the nursery and landscape folk that can describe what they do and how this would work.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about this retail, and maybe it will help better when we have the landscaper talk to us, but if we have retail outlets that provide these plants, they put them out, they haven't been tested, they're not labeled, from what I understand you're saying, are we going to have lack of bee-friendly product, because rather than risk labeling something that they may or may not know about, now they're just going to leave it without the label?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, I think you will see, and you can see in the room, there's folks, just regular citizens that are here. There is a high demand in the population for bee-friendly products, and the market would respond to this. There are going to be, I think it was in the paper about a week ago, that Bachmann's has decided not to use the neonicotinoid products, responding to that consumer pressure. So again, we're not saying that's up to the business to make that decision. What this bill does is says, if you don't know or you're in doubt, or you know that it has a neonicotinoid pollinate lethal insecticide, then don't label it. But if you do know, because you've got that, you've seen it from seed to plant, you've grown it, or you are working with vendors or subcontractors where you know that it doesn't have that in there, it hasn't been treated, then you can put that label up, and that's going to help you with the consumer. And I believe, just based on the input, you know, talking to people, they are going to respond. They want that product. And they're concerned if they're buying a product and it has the lethal insecticide in it.
I have a couple of other questions, but...
I think, you know, Madam Chair, at this point, I'm going to wait until we listen to the landscapers. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, in your definition of pollinator lethal insecticide, you specifically mention neonics, I can't say it very well. Anyway, neonics. And there must be others as well that would meet that definition. Why did you specifically name one class in your definition and leave out others, or just are you zeroing in on this one particular class?
Representative Hansen.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I label the neonicotinoids because we have the evidence that they have an impact on pollinators. But on line 1.10, I say includes but not limited to. So neonicotinoids is actually a fairly broad category that's systemic. You know, we have other systemic insecticides. Back when I was growing up, there were carbamates that were systemic, but I'm not putting those in. Those are more the agriculture. We're looking here at the horticultural use relating to this particular nursery labeling issue.
Representative Anderson.
And one more, Madam Chair. Thank you. And this kind of goes back to the amendment as well. When we're talking about the lethal doses or lethal insecticides, and then with the amendment, you're talking about just a detectable level. So the way the bill is amended now, if there's any detectable level, that would cause a violation of this statute, even if it's not to that lethal level. Is that correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, yes.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is fascinating discussion, and I'm going to ask a question a little bit more about the insecticide, which kind of ties into Representative Anderson's. Do we know if there is a life to the insecticide? I know a lot of chemicals have a certain life before they no longer become valid, or is this these some that are pretty much forever?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, the in general, and it's been a while since I've been in the department, but if we look at classes of both herbicides and insecticides from 40 years ago, they were more persistent. Let's say the herbicide atrazine, that was a fairly persistent in the soil, dependent on rainfall amount and pH of the soil. I mean, that had an impact. We used to talk about carryover on some of these products, where you'd have to make sure you're managing your plantings because of the potential carryover for the product that was applied the previous year. Over time, we have moved to different classes of pesticides, and pesticides being the term that includes herbicides, insecticides, mm-hmm. fungicides, to smaller dosages, less persistence. I'll use glyphosate or Roundup as an example. That breaks down in sunlight relatively. It has a short length of time.
Right.
The neonicotinoids, there's been relatively, I mean, these are relatively new class of insecticides. There's been some research that says that there's some persistence within the soil, but in general, looking at, I'm going to go to the example where we had testimony in another committee, sunlight and in bees, they were not able to detect things where they thought they may have been applied because they have sunlight and exposure that may break them down. So a broad, and again, we're dealing with a lot of different products and different chemistry, but in general, we have moved with pesticides from more persistent to less persistent in terms of being in the environment.
Representative Petersburg.
I thank you, and that's one of the concerns that I had or just will raise, that if an insecticide like this is applied in a greenhouse-type situation and it is brought out into the open in the sunlight, does it dissipate or the life effectiveness of it deteriorate so fast that within a matter of days it is no longer lethal? And that's the question that I'm just asking, because I am aware that varying chemicals do break down quicker than others, and so I was just curious about these particular insecticides.
And Madam Chair and Representative Petersburg, again, and I'm going to speak generally here, but the systemic insecticide goes through the plant and is more likely to be retained versus a contact herbicide or a contact insecticide that would be applied foliarly that is exposed to the sunlight and the environment that may break down faster.
We do have two testifiers. We do, Representative Erickson, you had a question, or otherwise we'll do that, and then we'll bring on the testifiers, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill in no way exempts the state nursery at Bedora from following these types of requirements, does it?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, they would apply. They couldn't label something as bee-friendly if it's not.
We do have we have Tim Power from the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, so if he would come down. Welcome to the committee. If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Tim Power. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association and a retired producer myself. The nursery and greenhouse industry have used neonicotinoids since they came out because they are a chemistry that provides greater safety for humans and yet still provides good killing power for the insects that are being targeted. We're starting to see research on neonicotinoids and their effect on pollinators, and that certainly concerns us. My interest was in testifying to the truth in advertising piece of this bill, where we certainly agree that truth in advertising is important and something that our association and our association's members subscribe to. As Representative Hansen and I talked about the formulation of this bill, he used the term pollinator lethal insecticide. We find it somewhat unfortunate, and yet I didn't have for him a better suggestion on a generic term to describe this type of pesticide. All insecticides, or most insecticides, are lethal to pollinators applied at the right dosage and the right timing. So this is a somewhat ambiguous term, and yet I understand what he's after. He's trying to create a class that is differentiable and something that we don't want to have in the plant when the plant is being sold as bee-friendly. In terms of plant labeling, again, we certainly subscribe to the concept and agree that this is valid. We do have concerns about the potential effect on the use of neonicotinoids going forward, because we do think it has been and probably will be good chemistry going forward. I know there are lots of questions. Many of those questions are not fully answered. I think the documentation of hypotheses of serious problems have not been documented by the numbers in studies that are agreed to by everyone. I know I'm creating very ambiguous testimony here, but we've got pluses and minuses here, and we have some concerns, but we certainly understand where Representative Hansen is coming from and support the idea of truth in advertising and truth in labeling. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I believe there will be some questions. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Power, would it be better to, maybe not, in the agriculture area, you have organic and you have certified organic. So could we, would it be more beneficial to have, this certification of this being not treated or something like that? Would that be helpful moving in that direction?
Mr. Powers.
Madam Powers. Chair and Representative Hamilton, very good question and something we have not explored fully. Again, because the bill seeks to outlaw certain labeling practices, we have less problem with that than the idea of banning chemicals. But that's an interesting concept that we have not explored.
And Madam
Representative
Chair,
Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder, would it be, could individuals label it as the plant itself is beneficial to pollinators, and underneath that have something to the effect that it may or may not have been exposed to insecticides? Would that be acceptable?
Mr. Power.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I'm not sure I follow the logic on why you would do that. I think that certain species of plants are known to be bee-friendly, but I think what Representative Hansen is trying to avoid is having bee-friendly species that become non-friendly through treatment. So I understand that we do like to push the bee-friendly species. However, that's really not what this bill is aiming at.
And Madam
Representative
Chair,
Hamilton.
And I fully understand that. I'm trying to take it from a nursery approach and address maybe some of the liability concerns in the event the nursery inadvertently labels it, because it is a bee-friendly plant, right? It's a bee-friendly plant, but it may have had exposure at some point in time. So to offer them cover, would it be helpful to simply say it may or may not have been exposed? And maybe that's to the author. Would that be acceptable?
Either Mr. Power, Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I want to go back, Representative Hamilton, to your question about organic, because in the industry, you could have, let's just talk about a plat of bee balm. So you're starting those plants out. You may be using a commercial fertilizer that is not organic. And so if you say that it all has to be organic, that may prohibit your use of the fertilizer, even though it's the insecticide that we're worried about. So I think if you were trying to, I think what my bill does is it's narrower, so you're providing that clarity for the consumer and for the industry that if you don't know, if you can make sure you've got that chain of custody where you have not treated it, then you can label it to say that it's bee-friendly. So that plat of bee balm still could have the commercial fertilizer. That's not going to affect the pollinators, but it's going to help those plants grow. And then you would be relating to your insecticide application. And there could be a foliar insecticide that's used for mites or something like that that is applied, but it's not the systemic. So it's for using integrated pest management that goes in and makes that application of, hey, we've got some mites over in the corner of the greenhouse, we need to treat those. That's not going to be, and you apply a foliar insecticide, that's not going to be the systemic that falls into the definition of the pollinator lethal insecticide. So I think those are things that help, where this bill is fairly tight. I think it's really tight, actually, because it's, if you know that you've got the chain of custody, you haven't treated it, you can label it. If you don't know, you can't. And then that provides the protection for the consumer.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question? No, you're just...
Well, I didn't, but I can always think
of one. I thought you had your hand up. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to ask one, and I'll do it now if that's okay with you. Representative, I understand where you're going with this, and I agree with what you're trying to do with the advertising piece. I think on the ag side, there could be a concern when we have defined neonics as a pollinator lethal insecticide, and then going back to that detectable level, at some point somebody may say, well, this cornfield has a detectable level of neonicotinoids, there I said it. And they may, there may be an attempt to jump that fence going from advertising to just banning the insecticide, which we've heard has some good uses because it has this detectable level in a cornfield, for example. But I understand where you're going, but I think there's also a bit of concern.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I've been around here for a while and worked at the Ag Department for a number of years, and I know the apprehension that's there for any time we deal with anything with pesticides. That's why I constructed the bill the way I did, so it's tight. You know, I pledge to you, on this bill at this time, this is all I have, I'm not going to use this for a vehicle to add anything on. I would like to move it to the floor, and we vote on it. And I would hope that it would be something we could get bipartisan support for. I don't have any intent of adding anything on. I understand the fear for the future, but in the future it would require the legislature to pass it. And I know our friends in the audience would be very vigilant if something came up like that. This bill is relating to the nursery stock, and that's my intent. I want to
Representative
understand
Keel?
Your fear.
And then Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the same concerns that Representative Anderson does, because I know your intent is not to be that way, but we like to add things. My concern here is that we don't really know. We suspect, but we don't have facts from what all the discussions we've had about pollinators. We don't know exactly. We see things. My question to you is, as a landscaper in the industry, do you support this bill?
And Mr. Power?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, what I have done is to poll members of my industry. We do not have a formal endorsement or statement of disapproval of the bill from the association. In looking at the various alternatives that seem to be before us concerning pollinators, this seems to be among the least onerous that are possible. I know that's not a ringing endorsement. It is a statement that dealing with truth in advertising makes perfect sense to us. We have the same concerns that you just mentioned yourself and Representative Anderson mentioned about mission creep. Again, this chemistry is suspect. This chemistry is still used heavily and far preferable to other chemistry. So that's one of the reasons we have not created a ringing endorsement here. There is general support for the concept that truth in labeling, even including this aspect, makes sense.
Representative Quisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question to the testifier. As I have done a quick search, I know other states are looking at this as well as the EPA. Has the EPA already taken action? Do they have something on this? And if so, are we conforming to that? Or how out of step with the EPA would we be on this labeling issue?
Representative Hansen or Mr. Power?
Go ahead. Madam Chair and Representative Quisha, the federal government has put labels, bee-friendly labels, on some insecticides. That is a rolling change that's occurring over time through re-registration of the pesticides. So there are labels, label information that's being done. But to my knowledge, there isn't any federal law relating to truth in advertising. This is, and that's again, I'm not before you with a bill on banning or regulating.
Yep,
I'm here on a truth in advertising bill.
Okay, we do have. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Power.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would agree. I'm not aware of anything in EPA that addresses the truth in advertising piece. It is strictly new additions to the EPA label requirements that address pollinators, but not in this regard. Back to Representative Teal's question on my personal feelings on this bill. I personally believe that this is a good way to go. Again, I don't speak in that regard for the association. I speak for myself and report the feelings of a few of my members.
Thank you, Mr. Power. And we do have some other people to testify, so we appreciate you coming forward. And thank you for your testimony. I believe Erin Rupp is here, and perhaps she and, I don't know if you wanted your business partner with you as well, if you're both going to testify or not. We have Erin Rupp on the testifier list. You'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name's Erin Rupp.
Sorry.
Don't worry. I think my grandma changed the pronunciation. Christy Allen and I are small business owners. We run the Bee's Knees. And I'm not a scientist. I'm a beekeeper. I'm a business owner. I'm an educator. And I'm here today because my business depends on healthy bees. And I testified, Christy and I and Catherine Sill, who's over here, testified at the Natural Resources and Environment and Ag Finance Committee a few weeks ago, so I recognize some faces. And I just wanted to say that our business depends on healthy bees. And we talk about bee-friendly plants, and that's bees need nectar and pollen to eat. And so bee-friendly plants are plants that are great nectar and pollen food sources for bees. One of the reasons why bees are suffering right now is because they don't have many, they're hungry. They don't have as many flowers as they used to. So we need to be planting more flowers, and so many people want to be planting more flowers for bees. There was a study that I meant to look up, but one of our main environmental issues as a state is pollinators. So people are concerned. We hear it every day in the work that we do, and so people are wanting to plant bee-friendly flowers, and right now, with this truth in advertising bill, they'll know that those things are actually good for bees. So a little bit of history behind what happened. Some plants were labeled as bee-friendly, and then they were also pre-treated with neonicotinoids, which are toxic to bees, in parts per million, in parts per billion. And so some of this, what Representative Hansen talked about before is related to impact of these chemicals on bees. And so having a clean choice for consumers to plant plants that are good for bees is awesome and would really help my business. yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Did you want to add things?
The reason we got involved with...
Just identify yourself for the record.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason we got involved with this was we experienced a bee kill. Christy Allen, sorry. We were part of a group of three beekeepers who experienced a bee kill in the city from a pesticide, and we knew this because we went under an investigation with the Department of Agriculture and with the University of Minnesota Bee Lab. And while the pesticide was systemic but not a neonic, what we learned from this experience was that we wanted people to be aware of what happened. We want to be able to put bees in the city and not have to worry about whether or not they're going to suffer from pesticides. And so we learned that, you know, what the things that bees are suffering from, and one of those things is they need flowers. And so we, as a group, were telling people to buy flowers, but if the group has no choice in whether or not they know for certain that that flower has been pre-treated, then we're just perpetuating a problem. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you. Are there any questions Yes, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, where are you located? Are you in the cities?
Yeah, our business is Minneapolis-based. Christy started the business in 2010. Her aunt and uncle are commercial beekeepers in Squaw Lake, Minnesota.
And Madam Chair, I have beekeepers, and I also have, Donahue's florists. And
right.
So, and I just wanted to say that to the bill and to the author and yourselves, you know, we read labels. I think we're a society now that we actually take time and spend the time reading labels to see what is in them. And I am concerned about the bees and the lack of them and going forward. So when I plant my flower bed this year, I want to know that I'm helping the bees, and I appreciate you testifying. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers? All right. Thank you for coming
forward.
Thank
you so much for having us, Madam Chair.
And so we have a House File 2798 and Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, my question earlier about is there a cost to this to the department, and if a fiscal note, and where's this bill going, Madam Chair?
The bill was intended to go to the general register, so the question is an appropriate one.
And Madam Chair, I was going to ask the Department of Ag to come down to state their position on the bill, and also they could answer the fiscal question.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you. So we have somebody from the Department of Ag. And who will come forward? So, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Sando Cruz, the Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Geir Friso, Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome to the committee. So, did you hear the question specifically, but also Representative Hansen wanted?
Madam Chair, could you repeat it for a minute?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was, with the department doing the testing, I'm assuming there's a cost that comes along with that. What's the cost going to be? Is there a fiscal note around this? Is this something that you can just absorb? And then where's the bill going after this, if it needs to go to a different...
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, this is one of these unique bills where it actually kind of crosses two different divisions within the department, both the pesticide division and then the nursery program is within my division. I guess in reading through this, I would envision that my division would have some responsibility for actual nursery label enforcement, which we do with other requirements. There's a little bit of a... When I see bills like this, I always run through my mind just sort of the practical and enforcement sort of things, and there's similar requirements for other consumer protection, for example, labeling plants to be non-hardy, and that does pose some enforcement issues, challenges for us, especially with situations like box stores where you have vendors that may not be directly plugged in with the nursery certificate. So there's some minimal cost with trying to contact those sorts of folks. I also, nursery stock in Minnesota is defined as perennials, and it's not annuals, so there's some questions in my mind as to if an annual is treated with a neonicotinoid, how that plays out and who has responsibility for enforcement. Lastly, we do have a little bit of concern about the effective date, since that is right in the middle of the shipping season for nursery stock. But to get to your question, Representative Hamilton, I think the cost to the nursery program will be fairly minimal, because the staff are already at these nursery locations and checking stock. But there's another half to it, and that's with the pesticides, and maybe Dr. Zachman may want to.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Joe Zachman, Madam Chair. Is there a question about pesticides from a member of the committee?
From a cost.
The cost perspective? Cost of analytical work?
Or follow-up, I guess, maybe.
There's the analytical cost of testing for these pesticides in our laboratory would need to be included in a fiscal note. And the costs of, I suppose, to the nursery industry, the cost of replacing these chemicals with alternative chemistries that can do the same job would be something to consider as well.
Maybe the question is, how often do you anticipate having this issue raised?
Well, perhaps that gets to the issue of the definition of a pollinator lethal pesticide, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The proposed bill provides a definition of a pollinator lethal insecticide as one that is absorbed by plants and becomes therefore makes that plant toxic to pollinators. Unfortunately, that's not the way things work. It is classified neonicotinoids as pollinator lethal, but when a plant absorbs a systemic pesticide, a systemic insecticide like neonicotinoids, does not necessarily make that plant lethal to pollinators. So the fact that it uses the term pollinator lethal when in fact concentrations of pesticides in plants may or may not make that plant lethal to pollinators is a concern.
That's Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, I think the question was on the fiscal note. The department has the authority to do the inspections in the nursery and in the pesticide area. Again, they have a lab where they have the analytical work that is there that's part of their existing authority and their existing ability to tap into those funds. They don't need the appropriation or an additional appropriation for doing that work that they're already doing. They already have that authority. So in terms of a fiscal note, I don't believe there would be one, because you have this bill is about truth in labeling. So to verify, they're going to go out and they're going to take a sample of the plant, take it back to the lab, and analyze it. That's what they do when they're called out to do a water sample or any other type of investigation, to do that analytical work, and they are not asked to do a fiscal note for every incident.
Madam Chair, we're not anticipating submitting a fiscal note. We do not see a significant bump in any costs that may come to us through this bill. So if that's any help, we weren't planning on drafting a fiscal note because it wasn't seen as either already part of our purview or a de minimis amount.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To the previous testifier, so then when you go to a nursery on a routine visit, would you automatically take tissue samples and take those back to the lab, or would you do it only in the case of a complaint against something?
And that's, I think, the testifier standing is the one that he's addressing.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
A lot of pressure here. Anyway, just wondering about your procedure when you go to a nursery on a routine visit. I assume you do that for other things. So would you automatically take a tissue sample each time you visit a nursery of some bee-friendly plants and take those back to analyze them, or would it only be on a complaint-type basis when you would go out and do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe in the case of this bill, that tissue sample would be taken if there was an interest in verifying the labeling at that nursery. I'm not sure to what degree there are routine samples collected, tissue samples collected from nurseries under our current nursery program.
Madam Chair, members, typically if our nursery staff encounter what they believe is a violation, if it involves pesticides, we would simply refer it over to the pesticide division for follow-up. We would be enforcing the actual labeling requirement, and so if we had some knowledge that there was a problem, but if it involved pesticides issue, we'd refer it to pesticide division.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. So would a nursery, or could a nursery do this as a kind of a protective measure to make sure that their stock is bee-friendly? And if they would do that, how long would the turnaround time be until they found out from you that it was, in fact, bee-friendly? And would it preclude them from selling the stock in the meantime?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, to the issue of whether they would be precluded from selling the stock in the meantime, I think is the intent of Representative Hansen's bill, that it would need to be verified as free of this insecticide. The problem for the nursery could be establishing a list of pollinator lethal insecticides from which to work. Neonicotinoids are called out in the specific legislation, but there is no other list that the Department of Agriculture knows of that categorizes or defines pesticides or insecticides as pollinator lethal.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Mr. President.
One of the reasons why the department supports this bill is because we really do see it, as Representative Hansen does, as a truth in advertising bill. We are not looking to create a list of pesticide, lethal pesticides to pollinators. Neonics, to some degree, have a complicated backstory. Part of that is neonics rose to, I would say, the Minnesota consciousness with, I think a year ago now, NPR ran a story outlining a nursery stock study, or rather samples that have been taken that show that neonicotinoids had been systemically uptaken into the flowers of some perennial plants that were sometimes 1 to 3 to 300 times the amount of neonicotinoid systemic uptake that you might see in a soybean flower. So for our purposes, it's somewhat complicated in that today's disease is yesterday's cure. The FDA, as I understand it, saw systemic uptake as a way to address the issue of drift, and actually recommended systemic uptake of some pesticides to deal with the aerial application of pesticides. So rather than weigh into all the complexities of pesticides and their differentiation, we're supporting this bill strongly as a truth in advertising measure.
Representative Erickson. Representative Erickson, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. If a brand at a certain nursery was found to be unfriendly, would that then label or wherever, would there be some alert going out to all the other nurseries that this is a potential to be contaminated, much like a milk recall or a
Madam
food
Chair,
recall?
Before Representative Hansen takes down, I would just say that from my regulatory experience as an enforcement attorney, you always have the duty as the agency enforcing any regulation to put the regulated on notice. So absolutely, that would be the responsibility. If we found a new chemical that was going to be listed within the provision or but not limited to neonicotinoids, if that was going to be expanded or opened up to other chemicals that we had identified and the science was sound behind it, then absolutely that would be communicated to nurseries and to the regulated parties under this bill.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or any public members that would like to testify, to come forward to testify on behalf or in opposition to this bill? Thank you to the department. You'll come forward, please, and have a seat and identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patricia Hauser. I'm from Shorewood, Minnesota. And I just want to say, just as a member of the public and a person concerned about bees, that I think this bill is a first step to say that stores can't sell poison plants as bee-friendly when they're the kind of plant that a bee would love but would be poisoned by. Maybe I've been around teenagers too long, but it's kind of like saying you can't sell poison suckers to kids. It's kind of like a duh. It seems like a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's important to pass this as a first step. Passage of this bill would be the passage of this bill would send a clear signal to plant sellers that they can't just sell plants that are wrong to be selling to people when they think they're getting a bee-friendly plant. I have friends who have had a horrified gasp when they realized that some of the plants they bought from their garden, thinking they would be helping bees and butterflies and other pollinators, only to learn that they were harming them. They were horrified. I had one friend say, her husband say, well, does that mean we have to go out and start digging these up? Maybe we should only shop at organic places. Maybe, I mean, they're really, people out there are really taking this very seriously. And this bill seems like just a simple way to get serious about this really serious issue. And I think it would help nurseries so that they too would become more conscious and more able to do their job. They want bees. They need them for their flowers and for their other plants. So I'm Thank just want to say that I'm a strong supporter of this bill.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no other testifiers and not seeing any other questions, we do have, did you want to come forward to testify? Please identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
My name is Margaret Munson. I live in St. Paul. I'm an entomologist and a beekeeper. And I became, even with my background, was not aware until this last year how many plants that are available in our nurseries and garden stores or hardwares have been pre-treated. It's good that the monarchs and the honeybees have attracted attention because we can document those. Beekeepers know about how many bees they have, and people studying monarchs at the university are recognizing a profound loss in monarchs. But they are only the tip of the iceberg. There are thousands of species of pollinators out there. We can't count them because people aren't studying them and counting them. But in addition to the honeybees and the monarchs, there are ants, flies, wasps, beetles that are all pollinating, going about their lives, improving our landscape. And with the loss of pollinators, it affects all of us. It isn't just the making of the honey. It's our crops, the fruits, vegetables, nuts, even ice cream. I'll let you think about that one. We are losing the health of our plant communities. The natural plant communities are unable to reproduce like they used to. We need the strength of the plant communities in interacting with pollinators for us to have a healthy landscape. And it isn't just our food. There are a lot of people in this room that really like to see birds. There's insectivorous birds. There's insectivorous reptiles, amphibians. So it's a part of having a healthy landscape, and this would be the first step in helping us identify. We go to a store, we want to plant something that we think is beneficial. There's lots of bee balm out there, and there's lots of other plants that are labeled bee-friendly. Well, they are if they're natural and they haven't been pre-treated. And I feel like some of these other people here, I don't know some of what I have in my yard anymore, even though I've tried to buy. I followed the chain earlier, several months ago, when I started calling nurseries, trying to find out, okay, I assume naively that a nursery that sold you a plant, planted the seed, and grew the plant, and you went and bought it. That's not true. Many of the large nurseries get their plants from, quote, all over the world. And to get through U.S. Customs, those plants are inspected. Plants are pre-treated, and we don't know it. So this would be a first step in letting us as consumers be aware. And it isn't just to beautify our yards. It's to create a healthy landscape. So I urge you to really think about this bill with your hearts.
Thank you. All right, we have Representative Anderson.
Just one more question, I promise, Madam Chair. The department, if I heard correctly, mentioned that they don't really have a list yet of all these chemicals. We're mentioning the neonicotinoids, but what other chemicals may be on the list, and will there be a list that they will know they are going to be looking for, Representative Hansen?
And just before you answer that, Representative Hansen, anyone who wants to testify, please come forward, because we've spent a great deal of time on this bill, and we do have a second bill that we need to hear, and we need to be able to spend time on that one as well. So please come forward and be prepared, and Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, as you know, the Department of Ag has to register each pesticide for use, so there's a label that's on file. The companies have to submit that information. Labels have information about what the impact of those are, what their caution, danger, warning is, both for humans and for the environment. So I think there's a way to track that through the existing regulatory system that they have, where they can, when there's new chemistry, if there's a new product that's being provided, that they can look at that label in their normal registration review.
And then go ahead, and you can also sit down. Be prepared to testify.
Hi, my name is Lou Harland. I'm out from by Excelsior, and I am here as a concerned citizen. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands the seriousness of the situation. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but China has started using humans mm-hmm. to pollinate their plants. And when we talk about cost, who do you think is cheaper, a human with a little teeny paintbrush up on those trees or a bee? Mm. I think a bee is a lot cheaper, so consider that money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Welcome. Hi, my name is Pat Kerrigan from Minneapolis, and I work with the Organic Consumer Association. We've worked with several other organizations. We in addressing the neonicotinoid colony collapse disorder issue, we had Show Bee Some Love Action at Home Depot during the week of Valentine's Day, Valentine's Week, along with several other cities. And Home Depot said that they're going to be working with their suppliers to remove neonicotinoid-coated seeds and plants, and then also that they were, if suppliers weren't able or willing to make that change, that they were going to be replacing them. I think the House can send a really, really strong message right now. Now is really the time that people's attention is on this issue because of how many bees colonies have died off across the country. In Europe, they were successful in banning the top three neonicotinoids that are on the market, and as well as their home improvement stores have removed neonicotinoid treated seeds and plants. And so the crisis is quite a bit more severe there. Now is the perfect opportunity to act, and I think it will not only send a loud and clear message to Minnesota suppliers, but also suppliers across the country, and states are addressing this issue all over the U.S. Eugene, Oregon City Council just voted to not allow the use of neonicotinoid sprays on public-owned land. And so the momentum's already going this way. You all can make a big, big impact in helping make the snowball roll, get bigger as it rolls down the hill. So thanks for your time.
Thanks
for addressing this issue so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, seeing no other members of the public who wish to testify and seeing no other questions from the committee, I'll move House File 2798 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen and Representative Bly. Welcome to the committee. Representative Bly, it's House File 2619, and this bill will be recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Ed Finance and Policy
Committee. I think we wanted to go to Environment. And
I think it's been requested by Higher Ed.
Well, I think that there was an issue about whether or not there was matching funds from the university, and I don't think that's at all going to happen. So I don't see the need for it to go to Higher Ed.
It's been requested by Higher Ed. So I think we'll maybe see what we can find out in the meantime, but go ahead and begin presenting your bill.
Very well. Chair and members, this is a bill which asks for an appropriation to support research that I think really gives farmers some new tools to deal with nutrient loss and also apparent problems of nitrogen flowing into the water. It's a problem that I became aware of in my district, and I talked to some farmers about it. And farmers, of course, don't want to see nutrient loss, nor do they want to apply too much nutrient to their crops. If we're going to encourage them to behave differently, we need to give them the tools to help them do that. And this is research that I have heard presentations about a couple of times, done by Don Weiss at the University of Minnesota. And it's very promising research, and it looks at developing crops that could serve as cover crops, but also will hopefully give farmers new crops to use for that can be profitable for their farms, and help them reduce their nutrient application and also preserve nutrients in the soil. So I do have a couple of testifiers to speak to the issue. Don Wise, who is here, Bobby King from the Land Stewardship, and also Tom Peterson will talk about it from the Farmers Union perspective. So without further ado,
Mr. Wise to begin? Is that kind of how you had it set up?
How would you like to proceed? Would you like to go?
Dr. Wise?
Sure.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Bobby King. I'm with the Land Stewardship Project. Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that's been working for over 30 years on promoting stewardship of the land. And we see the funding for the Forever Green Program as getting at the heart of the one of the most critical issues of stewardship of the land, which is diversity on the landscape. We need more cover crops on the land, and we need more perennial crops on the land for a host of reasons, water quality, wildlife habitat. But these options have to work in Minnesota's climate, and these options have to be profitable for farmers to grow. We know that there is a problem with runoff from cropland. I think everyone's familiar with the MPCA nitrogen report, which concluded that 73% of nitrates entering surface waters is from cropland. In LSP's analysis, this is not the fault of farmers. We've asked farmers to grow a lot of corn and soybeans through our federal farm bill, but we haven't given farmers the tools that they want and that they need to have a more diverse landscape, especially integrating cover crops into a row crop system to meet these water, to improve the water quality. So that MPCA report concludes by saying that research into new cover crops and perennial crops, they focus on energy crops, but there's also a lot of more room in this state for livestock on pasture, and pasture is a perennial crop. So we don't have the crops that we need. We don't have the crops that farmers are asking for to address these problems. That's what Forever Green is about creating. And really, we think the University of Minnesota is really the only institution that has the capacity to develop these crops in a way that will be useful for farmers and that can be get on the landscape in the time to make the difference that it needs to. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Wise.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, it's an honor to be here and to present the Forever Green Initiative. Some of you have heard pieces of it before, but the group that's here today is represented over here. Just to give you an idea, the faculty and the students and graduate students that are part of the program, and to this point, you know, it's been funded with federal dollars as well as University of Minnesota dollars to build this platform. And in your handouts, you have two documents. One is the PowerPoint presentation, a copy of that. But then there's also a thicker document that describes the overall initiative and some of the programs that are already in place. And what I should just suggest to you is that there is a platform on about 16 species that are being developed for this new generation of crop plants for the landscape. And I'll just leave you with this idea to hold on to. The idea is not to just plant things out there. We all know we can plant things out there, but why aren't they being planted? There's no economic pull. So each of these cases I'm going to be presenting to you, all of them are designed to develop new enterprises. Right, so those ecosystem services, water quality enhancement with an economic pull, so farmers have a reason to plant them on the landscape. Okay, in other words, corn wouldn't be out there today if it wasn't for the end use. Right, so we are coming from the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, that's how we think. In the same way that we thought about when we brought you corn, soybeans, wheat, and barley, right, there was a market. All of these ideas that we're presenting to you are with that focus, but also producing those ecosystem services. I could basically stop there and that would be be the presentation, but that's the general idea, right? So what I'd like to do is to say a few words to you about the overall initiative. And the idea is, where in the world did agriculture's diversity go? Why did it change? Some of you are my age. Not many anymore, but we remember the days when the landscape in the Midwest looked like this. It was a diverse set of plants, right? One strong component of that system in the 40s and 50s was what? perennial components. Pasture, alfalfa. Drive across the state of Minnesota today, and you're hard-pressed to find those fields, right? In other words, we've lost the perennial component of our agriculture system, right? So by the 70s, it looked kind of like this, right? Corn and soybeans, and if you go out there today, these same sites, that red spot of pasture, in most cases, will be gone, right? It's a corn and soybean system. Why did that happen? We moved livestock off of the individual farms, right? And in doing so, we replaced alfalfa with what? Soybeans, the protein, right? So in the development of that system, we lost that perennial component, that winter annual component of our agricultural systems. It is strictly now throughout from Winnipeg, Canada, all the way to Pennsylvania, is basically that same annual cropping system, right? Highly productive. We did good, except we forgot about the ecosystem services, right? And that's to me is the grand challenge. How do you maintain that high level of productivity of agriculture, but also to produce those ecosystem services? How do we deal with the water quality in a way that enhances the profitability to the farmer? That, to me, is the grand challenge for my department and the University of Minnesota as a whole. So what are some of the consequences? I'm tired of seeing these slides, right? But there isn't much that we can do about them. It's an annual system. It's open in the spring. Some of you have seen this slide before. Look at Minnesota. Find Minnesota on this overhead or on the slide that you have in your handout. This is a shot of chlorophyll in the landscape. Starting in April through May, look at the bottom slide. It doesn't cover. We do not have green on the landscape until the latter part of June in the Midwest. Active roots in the soil to hold that nitrate and nitrogen. Okay? July, we're in great shape. But look how fast it turns. You guys know how short the seasons are, right? Or how long some of them can be, like the winter. Count up the months of green cover on the landscape in that annual cropping system. It's July, August, and half of September. 2.5 months. That leaves a very long brown and white period, right? If you cover the snow, count the snow, right? No active roots in that soil except for that 3-month period. Nitrate nitrogen is mobile when it's not being taken up by roots, right? Down it goes, out it goes, into surface waters. So if you look at some of Giles Randall's work from Waseca from a number of years ago, basically looking at the water flow through tile line systems, when does most of it move through the tile line? That same period of time when it's brown, April, May, through June, right? And what's moving with it? Nitrate, nitrogen. There's nothing there to hold it through June, right? And what's moving with it? Nitrate, nitrogen. There's nothing there to hold it. Also in Guile's work of a number of years ago, these ideas I'm presenting to you are not new. In Guile's work, when he looked at the corn and soybean rotation using the best management practices, looking at continuous corn, the corn and soybean rotation, we were dropping 40 to 60 pounds of nitrate nitrogen into the tile line system. Look at the lines at the bottom of the graph. Alfalfa and conservation reserve. In other words, a mixture of grasses, perennials. The nitrate nitrogen loss drops to 2. And when I looked at this a number of years ago, I said, you know, we need to develop a program that moves us in that direction, but does it in a way that does not penalize the farmer. In other words, what does that mean? providing new economic opportunity for farmers to plant something on the landscape that holds that nitrogen in place, that holds the soil in place. Right? To me, that's the grand challenge. And that's why we've organized this team of people with the current resources that we have that have given rise to the 16 projects that are in front of you. We now believe it's a go. We now would argue that there needs to be substantial new investment over a long period of time, 10 years or more, to bring these new ideas into the marketplace. Just as my department brought you hybrid corn over the years, soybeans, wheat, barley, right? Today we have the wheat breeder that is currently still breeding wheat varieties because the private sector does not fill that entire niche, right? We no longer produce hybrid corn. So the idea would be, here would be to use a public investment to bring those products along far enough so it would be picked up by the private sector in the same way it happened with hybrid corn, soybeans in the past. That's the general idea. If you look at the number of you have seen this report probably more than I have, looking at nitrogen movement in surface waters in the state, you know, we're dropping out about 250 million pounds of nitrogen into the system, exiting through the Red River Valley and out through the Mississippi. That's 50 cents a pound. If you just look at the value of that nitrogen, keeping that on the landscape would increase the profitability of the agricultural systems, right? Just looking at it from an economic perspective, how do we keep that in the system? Someone's paying for that. That's what we talk about, increasing in figuring out ways of putting new plant materials on the landscape to increase the efficiency of the agricultural system. If you look at the nitrogen that's going into surface waters, you know, agriculture needs to take responsibility for this part, right? A large portion, as you just described, is coming from the agriculture system into surface waters. How do we reduce that, and how do we reduce it in a way that contributes to the efficiency of agriculture and increases the profitability? The report that was just referred to, as we start thinking about as a state, how do we increase the quality of our water? Looking in this case at nitrogen, right? If you just look at optimizing rates, right, you can get to about a 12 to 15% reduction in nitrogen loading. Just having farmers modify the rates of application, reducing them to be more efficient. But everyone's striving to get to 30 and above. Adjusting rates doesn't appear is going to get us there, right, based on this report. Modifying tie line systems will get you a little more, right, but certainly not to that 30% that we're all striving for. It appears that you're going to have to make a plant change. But look at the cost currently of making that plant change. To get up to the 30 by using plants, it's $1 billion a year. I doubt whether we can afford that. But that's with current technology. In other words, we don't have the plants to produce that economic return to the farmer to make that change. In other words, the public would have to pay that $1 billion. That's not what we're arguing for. We're arguing that it would be cheaper to invest in the development of profitable crops that produce those ecosystem services that would also give you that environmental protection. That's really the argument, right? So if you went out and have a farmer to make a change today to these systems, I don't have options for him other than grazing. Other than that, I really don't have good options as an agronomist going out making recommendations. Why don't these farmers change? That's why. They don't have real economic opportunities to make that change to get closer to that 30% reduction in nitrate nitrogen. Farmers would do it if there was economic opportunity to make that change. Well, you sitting in this room, you guys know that. That would happen. So in the long run, what we'd like to do is develop the vegetative material that would, in fact, give us that reduction in nitrogen loading into the surface waters and groundwaters of the state of Minnesota, and do it in a way that would not be a drain on the state coffers and would not be a drain in the profitability to our farmers in the state of Minnesota. So, what are we proposing? We're proposing those ideas that are in your handouts. Those are some of the original ideas. Not that there aren't more, right? You know, it just came from my team up here, right? There's obviously some other ideas that could be brought forward. But that concept of developing new sets of plant materials that would fit that landscape. And we would argue, we have enough annuals. I don't think we should work on annuals. I think we should work on winter annuals that give you that fall cover, spring cover, and perennials that will fit that landscape, ranging from, you know, things that could be used in grazing systems to biofuels. But I would also argue there's another set of great opportunities for the development of perennial grains, a perennial wheat type, right? And we have strong interest in our food industry here in the state of Minnesota. General Mills is working with us on the use of the grain from one of the perennial grains that we're currently developing. There's a strong interest in having that as a marketing component for the food system of the future from General Mills. There's one other thing I'll just point out to you. These are the geneticists in our program. A few years ago when I went to them with this idea, why don't we domesticate a new set of crops? You can imagine what happened. You know, like you've seen it, setting kind of the glaze over. Talking about things of domesticating a perennial grain. Well, they said, well, yeah, maybe 100 years. But these guys would now suggest to you that the things that you were projected would take 100 years, it's probably 10. Why? Well, you have all read and understand probably more about this than I do in terms of the understanding of the genomes of plants, of insects, of humans. Remember a few years ago when they published the human genome? Remember all the billions of dollars that went into doing that? I have a graduate student that's setting up here that sequenced the genome for one of our plants of interest in 9 months for $75,000. You see what I'm saying? That switch in capacity. I'm not talking about genetic engineering. I'm talking about understanding genes and in a classical breeding program being able to follow those genes of interest and move them into the lines that you're trying to select for. These guys would tell you it's a whole new world of possibilities in terms of domestication of plant materials that would provide economic and environmental opportunities. It's changed that fast.
We are running short on time, but right. So you may be toward the end anyway, but I know we had some questions, so I just want to,
yep.
If I can just have you, if you wanted to state one more comment, and then I'll
stop
questions.
Here.
Okay.
All the examples that I would like to present to you are in your handout, and they basically fall down this list, right? A field pennygrass. This is a cover crop that has value. It would work into the corn and soybean rotation and would be harvested for oil, as an example.
Right.
And then the series that you would see in front, you can read more about them if you wish.
We did have a question, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in all this, I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to try and make this short. In all this discussion, there are assumptions here that concern me. I live up in the northwest corner of Minnesota. I noticed your pictures of landscaping show it's not green. I can tell you that if we get in the field and things warm up, our fields are green by May 1st. We plant wheat. We plant corn and soybeans have gotten to be more, but we still have edibles, edible beans. We have, I can go through a whole list of crops that we have. There's some real misinformation here that really concerns me. I don't know as I see anybody from the Ag Department here that could explain some of what we do. We do talk about cover crops. There isn't tiling everywhere in Minnesota, and I know there's some conversation about whether that's good or bad. I've also heard that actually tile does improve the nitrogen situation that we're worried about, not deteriorate the situation. We're talking about spending money expanding this program when I believe between the University of Minnesota, the experiment stations, and also the contributions up in northwestern Minnesota from NDSU, that we do quite a bit of this stuff already. I have alfalfa fields half a mile from my house. I know that's not all over Minnesota, but I believe that we are doing some of these cover crops, and so I'm concerned about the money we're spending, talking about spending, on expanding this when, in fact, we already have this through the University of Minnesota and also the experiment stations in Minnesota. So why would we be adding?
Representative Bly.
In my mind, thank you, Chair, and Representative Keel, in my mind, this is important enough research, and no disrespect meant to the efforts that you're making on your farm and the other research that you see.
All my farmers, not just me.
I'm not trying to say that it isn't. I think that the promise of this research is something that does answer some concerns we have, certainly in my area when I talk to my farmers. And yes, I know that there's some work being done with cover crops, but not with the breadth of choices and tools that this research would provide. I believe it's important for the legislature to send a message to the university that this is important research and it should invest more in it. And if we want to really develop choices and tools for our farmers, this is really a good thing to invest in. And that's why I brought the bill. That's why I think it's really important.
Representative Keel.
So if we were to do this, what exactly is this going to cover? Where are we? What are we spending money on here? As far as what are we going to fund with this? New staff?
Madam Chair, Representative, what we have proposed is, you know, represented here. Basically, it would fund postdocs and graduate students working with our current faculty to advance our capacity in some of these new areas. For example, Jim Anderson is the wheat breeder that produces the wheat that is grown in your area of the state. Jim is a key player in the development of two of these. However, these projects are getting beyond the capacity of Jim to manage within his wheat program. I think Jim would suggest to you that he needs additional support to manage these projects like the intermediate wheatgrass and the pennycress program as it develops. As of this point in time, is starting to detract from his capacity to continue the spring wheat breeding program. So in each of these areas now, we would have students, as you can see here, that are actively engaged, along with postdocs that are actually carrying out the research in cooperation with the faculty.
Representative Keel.
Sorry. Thank you, ma'am. So none of these students / doctors are working, have opportunity to work in the different areas that the university already provides?
Dr. Weiss.
Yes, Madam Chair. The university funding system has changed dramatically. I've been here at the University of Minnesota 40 years. In our program, in my program, the University of Minnesota does not provide any funding for graduate students in my program. It is my responsibility to go out and develop my research program. The University of Minnesota will fund faculty positions, but the University of Minnesota, at least in my college, in CFANS, it is my responsibility to generate the funding for my postdocs and graduate students. In most every case, there's some exceptions. For example, a couple of the students were funded by royalty funds that came back from the release of some of the cereal grains over the years. There's a pool of funds that we can apply to for some of the funding for those. But in terms of appropriated dollars from the state of Minnesota to support graduate program education, postdocs, and graduate students, it's close to zero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let yes. other people ask questions.
Okay. We do have Representative Hamilton and Representative Anderson. I think we'll get started with that, but I think we might just carry this bill over till tomorrow. We have an afternoon meeting tomorrow afternoon, and maybe we can, because I think there are some questions, and unfortunately it looks like another committee is coming in here right after us. But I'm going to have Representative Hamilton and Anderson ask.
Madam Chair, thank you. All I was going to ask, Madam Chair.
Yes.
All I was going to ask is if we could hear this in environment finance as well, because I have some finance questions. Dr. Weiss, I really appreciate your approach to all this. And, you know, you talked about the economics behind all of it, and we must continue investing in research. And my questions are around the finance, where these dollars are going to be coming from, because we just heard a bill that Representative Falk was carrying as well, and are we competing for those same dollars? But I appreciate that support. I also want to echo what Representative Thiel's saying. You know, in agriculture, we continue trying to do, you know, what's best for all stakeholders. And there is an economic component in that as well. And again, I appreciate your approach, Dr. Weiss.
Thank you. And I think Representative Anderson's going to wait till tomorrow. And I apologize to Representative Fritz.
Okay.
We're once again putting her off. But thank you for the presentation. And I'm not sure that everybody will need to be here tomorrow. But I think it will be helpful to just have a little bit more discussion on this proposal. And I understand the frustration with the University of Minnesota on this, frankly, because this is something that Dr. Randall started many years ago having as a soil scientist, and I know Dr. Randall well because he's my cousin, but and I think he's been spending a lot of time, you know, over the years researching this, and we do need to continue to be able to provide that kind of research for the farmers and agriculture. So, Representative Bly.
I just wanted to say that I concur with Representative Hamilton that there are questions that should be answered in the environment finance, and that would be I will talk to Representative Pawlowski about his concerns, and perhaps we can allay those, or he could hear the bill after it went to environment finance if he really needed to hear it. But I know the bill that Representative Falk carried did not have to go to higher ed, was asking for similar kind of funding. So I'm not sure why it's necessary, but I will pursue that.
I think it's based on the University of Minnesota, and frankly, you know, they're.
But we could hear from them as well.
I think we might need to. But I appreciate your coming today and the presentation, and we will just carry this over till tomorrow, and we meet tomorrow afternoon. So with that, seeing nothing further, meeting adjourned.